You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here, taking a break from listening to a little Shouted Out Loudcast episode. Love Tom and Zeus talking all things KISS. Of course, I was listening to them on my new Raycon wireless earbuds. They have quickly become my go-to earbuds because of the comfort. These soft tips are the best I've ever used. And at this price, plus a Pantheon discount, Raycon is really hitting on all marks. Sound quality is great too. I really love having these three EQ options because I like more bass in the music, but less in my podcast. 8 hours of playtime for the battery is great as well. Surround sound, noise isolating, and awareness mode are all included. These are great earbuds. Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
Welcome to Let It Roll, the insanely ambitious musical history podcast hosted by Nate Wilcox. We've covered the early history of rock and roll, country music in the 20th century, the rise of hip-hop, disco, electronic dance music, and heavy metal. Stay tuned for our histories of Broadway, opera, punk rock, jazz, blues, ragtime, Latin music, and gospel. Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcast.com. Thanks to our very generous listeners, we've raised enough money to pay for a full year's worth of production and recording work. That's 104 episodes. Thank you all so very much. Today, Nate and Ed Legg dive into a new chapter of the 1980s based on Michelangelo Matos' book, Can't Slow Down, How 1984 Became Pop's Blockbuster Year. Email us at letitrollpodcast@gmail.com. Pop in those earbuds and enjoy.
It's time to Let It Roll. I'm your host, Nate Wilcox. I'm joined once again by Ed Legg. So I guess I should say it's time for 80s Roll, because Ed Legg and I are discussing Michelangelo Matos's Can't Slow Down, How 1984 Became Pop's Blockbuster Year. Ed, welcome back. Are you ready to return to the early 1980s?
I'm certainly ready to 80s Roll.
Awesome. So tonight we're going to be talking about the first two chapters of the book, which focused on first the radio. He zeroes in on WPLJ-FM in New York, talks about their transformation from a rock station into a contemporary hits station in the early 80s, and then gets into the whole decline and fall in the late 70s that caused this opportunity to arise in the early 80s when the record and radio industries sort of kicked themselves in the seat of the pants and started over. And then there's a second chapter that talks about the Sony Betamax versus MCA Universal Walt Disney copyright lawsuit. So we'll talk about the court ruling that allowed home taping to kill the music industry. But did it? I think we know the answer. All right. So let's dive in. WPLJ-FM. August 7th, 1983, New York City. This is where he zeroes in to start his chapter. And he's focused on Larry Berger, who is the program director of WPLJ. Berger had been there since 1974, transformed the station into an AOR, or album-oriented rock powerhouse, that was known for not just playing the usual Led Zeppelin, Who, Lynyrd Skynyrd, Rolling Stones, but a lot of softer ballads, including being the station that broke Mandy by Barry Manilow nationally, but plenty of John Denver, Simon and Garfunkel, even some R&B, Earth, Wind & Fire, Marvin Gaye, Stevie Wonder, even Disco King Barry White will be played on the AOR station. But by the late 70s, the market had gotten even more fragmented and bifurcated, because a lot of stations, the adult contemporary format had come out. And this was sort of the heir of the middle of the road format, or the easy listening format, which predated rock and roll, which was what people who wanted to hear Mel Torme and not Elvis listen to. And then suddenly nobody wanted to hear Mel Torme, but lots of people wanted to hear Air Supply. And so that's the gap in the market that adult contemporary stations filled in. Do you remember the plague of adult contemporary? Was it a nightmare for you like it was for me? Or,
well, you know, it's almost like I'm looking from inside the mirror, because I was under, as sad as it makes me to see the way things went, I was, you know, kind of part of the problem, because I was being led by the ear by an AOR station that had that was the flagship for the consultancy that, you know, caused this writ large. And what's fascinating to hear, you know, to hear you describe it again, to read it in the book, is that I remember sitting in my buddy's kitchen after spending the night over in Christmas of 74, and hearing Mandy and hearing Neil Sedaka and stuff like that. I mean, I remember I bought a Barry White record when I was in eighth grade the year before. And, you know, there was a big mix of rock covered a lot of things. And by 79, rock covered a lot fewer things. And you know, I remember just kind of how I wouldn't have said it then. I was, you know, I was still in my teens, but it's just amazing how the narrowing that happened, which I think was baked in the cake. I think when you start programming, doing the lowest common denominator, the denominators get narrower.
Yeah. It seems to be an unavoidable, aspect of that kind of focus on what you're playing and manipulating the audience to come back to your radio station day after day. And, you know, Lee Abrams is the corporate rock consultants that Matos brings up as, you know, Larry Berger was just controlling one station in New York. But yeah, there was a guy, Lee Abrams, who basically invented the radio consultant and the AOR business model, radio model in the early 70s. He wasn't the first radio consultant, but he was the first one to invent the album-oriented rock format. And he's just one of these characters, like, who grew up in Chicago, obsessed with radio playlists, and would make lists, you know, by hand, you know, try to keep up with all the stations and figure out what their playlists were by hand. And you just kind of realize when you learn about people like this that, you know, some people are just geniuses / obsessive freaks that are studying these things. That, I mean, anybody could have done what he did, but how many people are in high school obsessively memorizing the playlist for every radio station in their hometown? Not very many. And you know,
right. And then he decides to go to Atlanta, where I happen to live, and unleash it on my unsuspecting ears. And pretty much determining my dating life for the next 15 years, and even probably determining, you know, who would date me and who wouldn't. So, you know, I remember starting to get, getting crap from girls I was going out with who didn't want to listen to 96 Rock, which is the Abrams flagship. And, you know, by that time I was starting to see things like hostility at rock concerts. And, What I looked at it again today, and what just really is painful is that this was a dumbing down, that, you know, this was not Woodstock generation anymore. This is 10 years later. And, you know, nobody's standing around watching Hendrix do his thing. You know, nobody's, I mean, Prince was the heir apparent in many ways. He was a lot like that, but you didn't see him, at least at this point, running up to the rock stages. Now that would change as we know, as we go through the book. You and I've discussed this effect, and I've been hearing about this. I don't know what it is about the last year, just reading about it and doing some online research. And before I knew that this station was the flagship station for Lee Abrams, was in that consulting firm he worked for, was in Atlanta. Before I knew that, I just kept getting these familiar feelings, you know, that perhaps I knew something about it, because I just remember, you know, things like Boston and how ubiquitous the Boston album was in 76 and 77. And then it gives way to Foreigner, which gives way to In Kansas, and then REO Speedwagon and Bob Seger. I mean, all these things just came in succession.
Yeah, one after the other. And Abrams' initial insight, I think, was a pretty valuable one, because he was coming up in the era, like he hit his late teens in the late 60s, the Freeform FM era. And that was when, you know, sure, they're playing Steppenwolf and Creedence and Cream, but they're also playing Ravi Shankar and Bill Monroe and the Bluegrass Boys and maybe some Miles Davis. So you'd have these, you know, 20-minute Indian ragas or a full 30-minute jazz odyssey. And then you'd get to hear Yes or Cream or whatever. And so his initial format was what he called the Superstars format. And it's many people consider that the invention of album-oriented rock. And that essentially just cut out the non-rock. It cut out your Ravi Shankar, took away your bluegrass, cut out your jazz. The problem was that it also cut out, you know, it kept your Jimi Hendrix because he was already too big, but with the white rock audience, but it cut out your Parliament Funkadelics. It cut out your James Browns. It cut out a lot of your Stevie Wonders. I mean, obviously there were some stations that played some of that stuff, but there's this, you know, suddenly this wall of segregation falls, and it falls on FM rock radio. And locks this stuff in. But let's go ahead and hear our first song. And this is quintessential AOR radio. This is Caught Up in You by 38 Special. And that was 38 Special, Caught Up in You, 1982 album-oriented rock blockbuster. And for somebody like, for people like us that had grown up on Lynyrd Skynyrd and ZZ Top, to then suddenly get 38 Special and Molly Hatchet marketed as the same thing. Oh, you like Skynyrd? Well, you're going to love 38 Special. But it just didn't quite sound the same. You know, as much as I liked looking at the Molly Hatchet album covers in the record store, I was inevitably disappointed when I brought them home. It was not what I thought a Frank Frazetta, you know, Barbarian with an Axe album cover was promising. But, you know, that's what we got. And so that's one mix, one ingredient in the radio mix in the late 70s. The other big ingredient is this rise of disco radio. And it really was this rocket and immediate, you know, uprise and downfall, because, you know, and it describes one of the New York stations, 1978, WKTU goes all disco, and it went from a 1.1 rate market share, which is roughly the percentage of the audience share that the stations got, to an 11.2, and it did that within one reporting period, so in one quarter of a year. And that wiped out the WBLS, which had been New York's leading black music station. Frankie Crocker, the famous New York DJ, was the king of WBLS, and WKTU just wiped them out. And that creates this dynamic where WPLJ, the rock station we started talking about on this episode, then they move in more of a hard rock direction. As they described it, we're, quote, playing a lot of metal. But this is also a station that never played Black Sabbath, never played Iron Maiden. Metal, as defined in the late 70s, is not metal as we know it today. It included tons of stuff like Thin Lizzy, and right. Led Zeppelin was seen as a fundamental, you know, definitive hard metal rock band. Yeah,
that's how I still think of it.
And Aerosmith and other groups, AC/DC, that are not seen as metal by metalheads today. And then, you know, as Berger described himself, he said, by 1980, we only played records by white people with long hair who played electric guitar. And you know, even Billboard was covering it. Has AOR Radio become Lily White? I mean, 1980, Billboard article calling out AOR Radio for being racist. About 8 years too late, guys. That had already happened. And it's something I grew up with just taking for granted, being born in 1969. I can remember being, you know, astonished to find out that my black friends at school liked black music. Like, I was such a corn dog. I didn't know anybody who listened to black music, and it you know, was drummed in your head constantly that this was bad stuff. And, you know, so the early 80s were very revelatory for me, hearing Michael Jackson and Prince, and pretty quickly realizing how wrongheaded I had gotten, you know, and childish naivete, I guess I can excuse myself.
Well, I mean, hats off to you, because it didn't even occur to me what had happened. I think part of what softened it for me was I went to a majority African American high school where whites were in the minority. So I was being exposed that way. But at the beginning of my middle school years, it was like you just described. There was just as much on Top 40, just as much soul and funk and everything. And then we worked because of, I hate to say this, but partly because of the movie Deliverance and partly because of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, we were getting exposed to some hardcore country, because all of a sudden it was okay for my dad to like bluegrass, because that meant he wasn't a redneck as far as my mom was concerned. And that made way for Willie as well. I'm glad you're laughing. But I mean, very bourgeois, totally. But
well, we've got that same stuff in my own family. My mom was, you know, grew up in Roger Mills County, Oklahoma, literal cotton picking dirt farmer. And she felt she was too good for country. And it was only, you know, as an adult who came back around to liking Johnny Cash and Hank Williams, that she began to open herself up. And when her kids started listening to country, then, you know, she would enjoy it with us. But definitely saw herself as a Glenn Miller person, not a Bob Wills person. And that's
sure. Yes. That she was aspirational in her taste.
Yes. And yes.
But you know, I worked for the student newspaper in my high school, and one of the kids went and saw Bootsy Collins at the theater where I worked as an usher, which means I could have gone and seen him and didn't. I also could have seen Parliament around that time too, I ghost wrote his review of Bootsy's, and it's like, you know, why didn't I go see it myself? I mean, I was already being led around. I was already kind of a radio zombie. So I feel like I was part of the problem, I confess.
Well, you know, I mean, we're all just consumers in the marketplace, and have very little control about what information we're exposed to and how we're led, you know, by the people that are marketing to us and devising this stuff. And another big factor in this period was that all through the 60s and 70s, the baby boom was this huge demographic wellspring of riches and numbers and masses. And so, you know, as soon as the first baby boomers hit high schools in the 1960s, marketing to youth is a no-brainer because you've got this huge population bulge that are young, and yeah. it went on, you know, the bulge in our demographics went on into the early 60s. So there was a full 15 yeah. or so years of this, but by the late 70s, what they're discovering is that, you know, stations like WPLJ that were aimed at young males, they discovered they were running out of young males, that in 1982, suddenly the American median age was 31, which was back up way higher than it had been, I think probably in 20 years. And yeah. that the 12 to 24 demo shrank by one third in the 1980s. So you go from the baby boom to this shrinking Gen X, which was just not that appealing, you know, a market because it wasn't that big. And right. you know, but this combination of disco, AOR, aging AOR, like they're running out mm-hmm. of good stuff, and they're, you know, they've squeezed all the juice out of ZZ Top and Lynyrd Skynyrd. All those ZZ Top's about to have a big comeback, but and now they're yeah. reduced to you know, 38 Special and REO Speedwagon. You know, Boston only put out the two albums in the first 10 years they were around, and the second one wasn't as good as the first one. And so you're hearing a lot more Styx and Kansas and all that yeah. stuff on the radio. And then that is one of the factors to the 1979 record biz going bust. And you know, there was a recession, there was the Iranian hostage crisis and the oil embargoes of the late 70s. But this was the first time that a recession had impacted the music industry since the end of World War II. So you just had this industry that thought it could do no wrong and thought it was recession proof. And they went howling into the teeth of the biggest recession of the era, you know, printing up 12-inch singles that nobody wanted to buy. I mean, the audience for 12-inch singles was limited to DJs, essentially, and they're printing up gazillions of disco 12-inch singles that, you know, and this is, by this point in time, Ethel Merman is putting out disco records, so it's disco is way, way not what it had been just a few years earlier. Anyway, but let's play our next song and continue the discussion. This is Pat Benatar's Love is a Battlefield. That was Love is a Battlefield by Pat Benatar. And Pat Benatar is one of a wave of new young artists who managed to be novel sounding enough to get people's attention, but not so novel sounding they get the dreaded punk label, which at this point meant you were not going to get played on the radio. So you've got people like Pat Benatar, Billy Squire is another one that jumps out that sort of refigured a new way to make hard rock that sounded new, used the new technologies, so it sounded like the 80s, but wasn't so weird and off-putting that it's going to make radio programmers run away because they don't want to play anything that sounds like the Ramones or the Sex Pistols. So, you know, that was kind of the gist. What was your exposure to punk and new wave and the whole take on that culture clash?
It was really a lot of it was word of mouth. We had Atlanta had like it wasn't public television, but it was VHF back when we had two switches and you could go to the VHF channels. That's what
you mean UHF? I think
VHF. UHF, was, yes.
Yeah. Thank VHF was thank the main one. Yes. UHF was. Yeah.
Yes, and Ted Turner owned one of those Channel 17, and he actually early on when he bought that channel would come on and show you how to put an antenna on the back with a coat hanger. And they also had videos. They had early 70s shows where they'd show psychedelics and play music on those UHF channels. Channel 36 was the other one in Atlanta. But somehow we got one of the things I was thinking about this today. Tom Petty and Blondie toured with the Kinks around 78 and then 79. And then it kind of trickled in. It kind of cracked, you know, a few cracks in there and came in, punk did, and new wave. And somehow we got exposed to it enough. And I was following a band that had that was hard rock, but had a new wave edge to them in Atlanta. I went to Athens. It might as well not have been a scene in Athens. There was one, but it was so underground that I didn't even know about it at that point, other than the B-52s, who had already left Athens. They weren't even in Athens when I got there, which was 78,
yeah, they moved to 79. New York pretty fast, yeah.
Yes, right. I mean, right away. Unlike REM, those guys still apparently live there and several other houses across the world, too. But what's interesting is you played 38 Special, and I didn't say this before because I was trying to formulate what I was going to say. I saw 38 Special open for bands five different times from summer, end of summer 76 till Peter Frampton 77, about a month before this Lynyrd Skynyrd crash. And every one of those times, the only singer in that band was Ronnie Van Zant's brother, Donnie,
yeah,
which means Don Barnes, who's the lead singer on Caught Up in You and all of their other hits, hadn't started singing yet. And I don't even know if he was writing songs yet, but that's 4 years before 3 years before Caught Up in You comes out. And it's a completely different sound. And it was very radio friendly. And just like Pat Benatar, it isn't even an original 38 Special.
Yeah, no, in no way, shape or form is it Southern rock. And they were one of many acts. That reconfigured themselves. I think the Police are probably the ultimate exponent of that strategy, because they were a prog band, or members of prog bands. Like Andy Summers had been in Eric Burdon's New Animals in the late 60s. And they, you know, cut their hair, bleached it white. They had the look of punk, and then they got a whole bunch of effects and pioneered this sort of faux reggae, very technological. And I'm not trying to diss them. They wrote great pop songs. And they were very
creative.
Yeah, very innovative with what they were doing. But it wasn't punk or reggae. It was this new thing, and had this massive influence on bands like Yes with Trevor Rabin, or ZZ Top 2.0. Everybody figured out, aha, this is what we can do. We can get the new sounds, the new equipment, the new drum machines, the new synthesizers and samplers, and the new recording techniques, gated snare drums, which I think it was either Phil Collins or Peter Gabriel that pioneered that. I want to say it was Peter Gabriel that did that first. Mm-hmm. But anyway, yeah, this whole new way of making sounds becomes a thing. And then in 79, the record biz goes bust. 11% drop in sales from 1978, which is massive. I mean, just, you know, a 5% recession really, really hurts. If you can remember back to, you know, 2008, or the last time we had a lasting recession that bad. So an 11% drop in sales is just murder. That's pretty close to depression level for that one particular industry. And, you know, disco took the heat for that. Everybody said, oh, we went too far with disco. And, you know, there was the backlash at the Chicago Detroit game, the disco demolition night in Chicago. And, you know, and people like Nile Rodgers are feeling pretty desperate. Nile Rodgers of Chic, because suddenly Chic goes from being this platinum act to they can't sell records on their own, nor can he get gigs producing records. So later on, he's going to survive and make his comeback, work with Blondie, work with Debbie Harry, work with Madonna. Madonna and David Bowie are the ones who really broke it wide open for the guys from Chic. But, mm-hmm. you know, but this depression goes on and on. Like 79, there's a big sales bust. 80, no recovery. 81, no recovery. In fact, Paul McCartney withheld his Tug of War album for months until 1982. CBS Records lays off 300 people. And this is at the peak of Walter Yetnikoff's power. So, you know, they were the number one and number two label up against Warner Brothers at this point in time. Platinum albums are down 10%. Gold albums are down 20%. But the savior is working on the plan. And the savior in this instance is Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson, who are working on Thriller, which is the sequel to Jackson's Off the Wall album from 1979, which was one of the few albums from that period that did not suffer. Off the Wall sold 7 million units. Things are so bad, though, that Quincy and Michael are only hoping for 6 million sales for Thriller, which we can laugh now that it's gone beyond 30. But, you know, that their plans are relatively modest. But it made it, you know, it comes out in November of 82. It's platinum by January, sold 1 million copies, or I guess $1 million worth of sales. Then number one album by February. But the interesting thing was that their master plan was to have hits in every format, including album-oriented rock. And Quincy Jones was very clear with, I need a My Sharona. My Sharona was the hit song by The Knack in 79, one of the few, quote, new wave songs to break it big. And, you know, he told Michael, I need a black My Sharona. And Michael comes back with Beat It. And they call Eddie Van Halen. Cut the solo. The rest is history. Let's take a quick break from our sponsors. When we come back, we'll talk about the rest of the Thriller radio plan.
Hey, Pantheon listeners, Christian Swain here. Another day, another podcast I'm working on. This time, it's Famous and Gravy with Amit and Michael. I want to let you know that I loved the Factor Meals package so much that I re-upped for myself, and then I sent a package to my in-laws. Like I was with my first shipment from Factor Meals, the in-laws were as excited to try one of the prepared restaurant quality meals. Well, they got the shipment to Protein Plus meal plan and were very impressed. See, being in their 80s, anything to make the meal prep easy is a plus for them. They heated the oven per instructions and minutes later were enjoying a very delicious, nutritious, and dietitian-approved meal. One big win for me. But what really floored them was the taste. Like I told you, it's surprising how good these meals taste. Restaurant quality indeed. And like my own shipment, it really was everything Factor Meals said it would be for some seniors. No prep, no mess meals. Factor Meals are 100% ready to heat and eat. Take it from me and my in-laws. Head to factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. That's factormeals.com/pantheon50 and use the code Pantheon50 to get 50% off. Thank you, Factor Meals.
Hey folks, Stefan Shirazi and Renee Richardson here from the Metallica Report.
And we are proud members of the Pantheon podcast family, where the best of music and podcasts unite.
We've got something pretty cool for you. We're giving away an exclusive Metallica merch package worth over $250.
That's a whole lot of scary guys, skulls, M72, and other sought-after Metallica swag. And we've made it easy for you to win. Follow and share the Metallica Report, and you're in the game. Go to pantheonpodcast.com/Metallica, enter your email, and hit that button to be entered to win.
And just like that, you're eligible for our monthly exclusive Metallica merch package.
And guess what, rockers? You can enter every month, so just do it. And while we love our global brothers and sisters, the lawyers won't let us ship outside the U.S.
And so Beat It comes out off the Thriller album and is quickly added by dozens of AOR stations. It's the third most added AOR title in December 1982 after Sammy Hagar and Bob Seger's Latest. And it's followed pretty quickly by Beat It, which is a straight up R&B track. None of the concessions to rock that Beat It had made. I mean, Billie Jean, not Beat It.
Yeah.
And sorry. And but stations like WPLJ are experimenting with their new format. And so they're open to playing things like Beat It. They're already playing Prince's Little Red Corvette. And it's interesting to read Berger talk about his test audiences, because by this point, stations are calling up listeners and asking, hey, what do you think about this? And I've always made fun of this because it's like, you know, you hold up a phone to a speaker and get the crappiest version of the sound of the song and ask some, you know, as a young sexist, I was, you know, you call up some dumb housewife and, you know, I'm no longer that sexist, but that's how I thought when I was 12 or 13. And sure. They, you know, and then play them something they can barely hear and ask them what they think. And so WPLJ found that, you know, the initial feedback was very negative, but by the third week that their test audiences were loving this stuff. And there was, you know, there was holdouts, they called them earth dogs, that would write them these letters, you know, where's the real red blooded rock and roll and everything. But the general crowd was down with Michael Jackson. Like, people liked Michael Jackson in the early 80s. This is the revelation we're bringing in. Do you remember your first exposure to Beat It? Or
oh, absolutely. You know, I remember to back up just a little. 79 was Atlanta had always had a one big outdoor festival every year in the summer, and 79 was the year that a kid climbed up the flagpole at the Georgia Tech stadium where they had the festival, climbed up the flagpole and hung a Disco Sucks sign up. And it just played right in. The thing about the disco backlash was it played right into the Earth Dog mentality, which was also taking over. And by then, my buddy and I had gotten into punk and were starting to actually dress new wave. And we were both in college. At this point, we went to our last REO concert that summer as well in 79, and we stuck out like sore thumbs. At least, though, nobody threatened us like was already happening at Ted Nugent shows the year before. So, you know, the hostile white male had really become the rule in rock concerts, which is way different from Woodstock Nation. But jump to what you were saying about Beat It. I was in Birmingham, Alabama, and that was the station I was getting for my first 10 months out of college. I worked at an Alabama daily newspaper, and so I could get the Birmingham rock station, definitely AOR. The Who had just done a tour, and they'd been huge on that Who tour, so it was totally kind of in keeping with that. But I was in Birmingham on a Saturday, and I was about to move to Columbus, where I would get this total dose of Duran Duran and who we're about to talk about. But I was in Birmingham in a drive through and all of a sudden Beat It comes on. And at that point, it felt like Michael Jackson singing a Van Halen song. And that was my reaction to it.
Yeah.
And I love that song. I mean, I love the way that guitar sounds at the beginning. And if it hadn't been, you know, part of this Thriller tidal wave, I would, you know, probably would have liked it the way I liked My Sharona. And I'm not saying I turned against it because of Michael. That's not it at all. But that song, they were playing it. They weren't playing Billie Jean. But as you said, Billie Jean came out a little later. I've already moved to a town in Southwest Georgia, a little bit bigger town, but it doesn't have that AOR station. It's much more of the hits, contemporary hit station. And all of a sudden, I'm getting just the full dose. And Prince in 1999 was the big Prince album. So I'm getting plenty of Prince, Dexy's Midnight Runner. I think they list in this chapter, they list all the songs that he added to WPLJ.
Yeah.
Every single one of those songs I heard several times a day that in 83. That's exactly what I was hearing.
And what you were referring to with CHR, Contemporary Hits Radio, that was just a new name for Top 40. Like Top 40 had become.
Yes.
So everything old becomes new again. And so the Top 40 format was resuscitated as CHR. And, you know, it's getting. But the other big player that comes in is MTV, which is launched August 1st, 1981. And Matos has a statistic that's just totally telling. It played 750 videos, different videos, in its first 18 months. Only 24 of those were by Black artists. And he's got this great quote from Bob Pittman, who is the boss of MTV at the time. Bob Pittman goes, "I'm tired of all this, quote, racist stuff. Why doesn't anyone talk about the barriers we have broken down, like between punk, new wave, and mainstream rock?" And it's just like, dude. I mean, it's like he's so proud of himself. We got white guys to talk to each other, you know.
I don't remember a single one of those black artists, but all I remember is Michael. That's all.
Yeah,
I
Michael was the first one that they played to any significant amount. I mean, I think I've read in the past who they were, and you know,
Prince is another one.
Prince, I think they had played Prince before, because they would use Prince to whenever Rick James would go after MTV. They would say, "Oh no, we play Prince," like just to screw with them. But you know, by this point, though, the record industry has figured out, and it figured out pretty quickly, that MTV could move units. And that's, and we talked about this before, but all of a sudden in Wyoming, you've got a town with MTV, and they're selling the Buggles album, and they're selling Kaja Goo Goo, and they're selling Icicle Works. And the record store in the other Wyoming town that does not have MTV was not. So it was very obvious very quickly. And then, you know, in April of 83, MTV finally plays Billie Jean by Michael Jackson. And he had debuted that on March 25th, 1983 on CBS, on the Motown 25th anniversary special, which was mostly people playing, you know, old Motown artists playing old Motown songs. And Michael and his brothers did a medley of old hits. But then he says, "But I also like the new stuff," and kicks into Billie Jean, you know, Moonwalking, and you know, the rest is history. Everything's legendary. But let's go ahead and play another song that was big in this era. And this is one of the members of the second British invasion. This is The Fix, with "One Thing Leads to Another." And this is the kind of crazy new wave stuff you could hear on MTV and contemporary hits radio in the early 80s. And that was "One Thing Leads to Another" by The Fix, one of the classics of the second British invasion from the early 80s. And yeah, I mean, it makes obvious sense that Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson had a master plan when they made Thriller and the whole marketing of it. I mean, stuff like that doesn't just happen. People plan that stuff. People execute that stuff. Obviously, there's a lot of inspiration, you know, but it was also a lot of planning. And it's just interesting. It's like the perfect case study. And you know, how do you make the biggest selling record of all time? Well, you plan it. You put a song for every radio market. And, you know, there are certain things like having Michael Jackson as the front man and this electrifying performer and inventive dancer who just encapsulated the era. Like, it's been interesting to go back. You know, Michael Jackson acquired so many negative images in my life and everybody's life between 1983 and now. But if you go back and you watch the videos from 1983, when he's only had one nose job, he's young, he's beautiful, he's this, and he's already been a beloved performer for, you know, 13 years by this point, and you know, just blew the doors off. And the level of fame that he got in response was even bigger and crazier than the level of fame. And I think, you know, contributed to his and self-indulgence and downfall. And, you know, I'm not going to get into the whole.
His eccentricities, for sure.
Yeah.
Put it lightly. But, and, you know, he was, the thing that gets me is Off the Wall was really good. They were really good.
Oh, and, yeah. Off the Wall is so
I don't want to jump ahead, but he mentions how much the Victory Tour of 84 was how similar it was to the 81 Jackson's tour when they were still they were still as strong as a group. And Michael hadn't gone out and become this, you know, mega star. But I mean, the guy was clearly immensely talented and a cutting edge performer and composer and working with one of the best ever, Quincy Jones. And it happened to be good stuff. And I mean, and then it's got basically 2 years worth of hits that keep coming out and keep influencing. You know, it was kind of like 1964 to 74 and in a couple of years, you know, boiled down to one album or one or two albums.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, you know, just an amazing accomplishment. And Matos talks about, you know, some of the other ingredients and that Prince and Michael were just the knife's edge of a whole wave of cutting edge R&B that was coming out. We talked about Rick James, but you also had the SOS band, you had Patrice Rushen, you had the Gap band. I mean, you had Cameo, a great time for R&B. Plus, like I mentioned, you had this whole second UK invasion and people like Joe Jackson and Men at Work, who are Australian, but, you know, effectively British for our purposes. Elvis Costello, you had the Clash scoring big hits. And so all of a sudden, you know, you had to play this. And Lee Abrams was talking about there were fewer and fewer things you could play for what he called the Rock Coalition, which inspires Matos to, you know, contrast the Rock Coalition of the 60s when you had the Beatles and Bob Dylan and the Four Seasons and the Beach Boys, but you also had Sam and Dave and Otis Redding and the Supremes and the Temptations and Smokey Robinson and Marvin Gaye. And they were all being played on the same station, marketed to the same audience of kids. And, you know, as I think it's the manager of Joan Jett said in a quote Matos has that, you know, by the early 80s, radio plays music for the 14 to 18 year old audience, the 30 to 35 year old audience, the 50 to 60 year old audience, or for white, or for black, or for Chicano. And only 2 out of the 5 stations are willing to play new records. So they've got the audience super split and by demographics, by age, by race, by background. And then they're mostly feeding them oldies. And the thing is, when you do that, you're eating your seed corn. And that's what the record industry did. Like, people love Dream On and Stairway to Heaven and Freebird. You keep playing it every day and people stop liking it as much. And that's what they basically had done. And the other thing that happens in the second chapter that he discusses is that the Supreme Court rules in favor of Sony and against MCA Universal and Walt Disney. And this went all the way to the Supreme Court. The Sony won the first time, then lost on appeal, and then went in the Supreme Court. And essentially, the case was that if you sell a videotape machine that allows people to tape shows and then fast forward to the ads, that you're stealing, that you're not allowing the TV stations to profit and their advertisers to reach their audience. But the Supreme Court at that time ruled that, you know, time shifting does not constitute contributory infringement if the product is widely used for legitimate, unobjectionable purposes. So they're saying that the legitimate, unobjectionable purpose of tape recording a TV show that came on your TV that you paid for did not infringe, even if you fast forwarded through the ads. And the record biz was just outraged. And yeah, you know, they were working on all this stuff. And it's interesting that the way that the fight against cassette recording, because people had cassettes and they would record on their cassette decks, they would record radio shows, they would record vinyl albums. And the record industry acted as if this was the MP3 piracy that, you know, you're going to see in the late 1990s, early 2000s. And they had these overblown statistics saying that, you know, twice as many records are taped as are bought legally, and we're being bled white and all this money is stolen from us. But it was controversial. Even people in the record industry, they shout out the main guy from Island Records. Island Records actually sold their cassettes blank on one side to encourage home taping. And so, you know, not everybody in the record industry was feeling that way. But this, to me, is kind of the last time that the courts make a good decision in intellectual property yeah. and technology, that this is not what we see in the 90s. This is not how the rulings on hip hop go. This is one of the last times when I think the technology is straightforward enough and the judges are, I don't want to say moral or ethical, but they're not bought. I mean, that's the right. reality of our legal system now, is that most of the time the big companies can reach the judges. And so
yeah.
this is one of the last sort of good legal decisions we're going to get in music history. Do you remember that whole debate about how home taping is killing music?
Well, you know, it's always going to come back for me to what I was doing with it myself, which was, I bought a lot more cassettes. I had a cassette player from 1970 in a car from 1978 till the car that I bought in 95 and drove till 2003. So basically I was still driving a car that had a cassette player in 2003. I probably didn't listen to cassettes anymore in it, but I mean, I think I bought whole on cassette still. I mean, I bought a lot of things on, and even if I didn't buy it on cassette, if I bought it on vinyl and I wanted to listen to it, I'd tape it on cassette and then play it in my car. I never gave anybody else a copy of it. I wasn't selling extra copies, you know, online, and I never heard of anybody else doing that. It was so, it was an apt ruling, and it totally fit with what we were, how we, the consumers my age in our 20s were doing with things like that. And I mean, it's true. There are a lot of cassettes, and I never thought that the cassettes that I bought from record companies were as good as the ones. They didn't, to me, sound as good as the ones that I had make on my deck from my stereo. So that was it for me. It wasn't really, any sort of money making. It also, and we talked about this last time, I think it was a lot easier being a musician. I was in a band later in the 80s to actually traffic our music with a CD. We didn't have to get somebody to burn, with a cassette. We didn't have to get anybody to burn it, or cut a record for us. I mean, most people, we did get a tiny bit of radio play. It was basically perfunctory, but it was a cassette we sent, and it was just way easier to decorate that up to make it look professional, everything like that. But you're right. I mean, the way, it's interesting reading that chapter, and Rehnquist was the one that dissented in that big ruling, that what a bad idea this was and how this was letting a cat out of the bag, or, you know, that this was going to cause all kinds of things. And it didn't.
No, not at all. I made mixtapes and was given mixtapes, and you know, my older brother would make copies of his albums and evangelize to us. But we were looking for that vinyl or you know, the original stuff. I mean, having one copy, you know, of a tape, I couldn't, you know, before you get to digital sound, the audio quality would degrade every time you made a second copy. So by the third or fourth generation, it's just mush. And so, the whole argument against home taping was basically specious nonsense. And this is one of the last times that the courts, you know, make a good rational ruling, that then you can see from the fruits of it that this did not destroy the record industry. In fact, the record industry goes on to have its best ever decade in the aftermath of this decision. And the same for the TV studio, the movie studios that the original VCR Betamax suit was about. But let's hear our last song. This is a Denise Williams from the Footloose soundtrack. Let's hear it for the boy. And that was Denise Williams. Let's hear it for the boy from the Footloose soundtrack, which was another epochal movie of that year. I would say that Purple Rain, Flashdance, and Footloose are the three big movie musicals of 1984. And, you know, just had a massive impact and essentially figured out how to make a new way to make rock movies. Because originally you had, you know, the Elvis movies like Jailhouse Rock or the Beatles movies, Hard Day's Night or Help. And then after the Beatles, you get a generation of basically documentaries about rock music like Woodstock or Monterey Pop or Gimme Shelter. And then there's a wave in the mid-70s of spectacle movie musicals like Tommy is done by Ken Russell in this just totally overblown way. But by the early 80s, they figured out, oh, we can make a series of music videos and call it a movie. And that's essentially what Footloose and Flashdance and to a lesser degree Purple Rain are. And it's a whole new way of solving the singer movie star problem. Very different from the approach they took with Bing Crosby or Frank Sinatra back in the day, and definitely different than Jolson. But did you guys see any of those movies in the theater, or were you too old for them?
No, I'm glad you asked. I actually saw it, Footloose, and I was I really was attracted by the trailer. I was not a huge Kenny Loggins fan. I mean, a lot of my friends were. He was huge then. I mean, he was like Bob Seger or a lot of the other. He was an obvious, and then he'd done the theme for Caddyshack. I think the trailer was just really good because they used that guitar riff and Footloose to great advantage for the trailer. And so I did go see that, and I enjoyed that. I actually did see Purple Rain in the summer. I succumbed to Flashdance in a drive-in. That was the closest I ever got to seeing Flashdance. How about you?
I saw Flashdance on cable, and I want to Steph's point now that Flashdance actually came out in 83 and Footloose and Purple Rain,
right? Good point. Okay.
But
I didn't even see it till 84 in a drive-in.
Yeah. I saw it on cable. I think I saw all of them on cable. No, I saw Purple Rain in the theater, but the other ones I saw on cable first.
Okay. Good job.
And both Flashdance and Footloose, I felt I was too cool to be watching, but I still watched them. And you couldn't avoid the soundtracks of either one of those, and you couldn't avoid enjoying them really either, even if you did think you were too cool. And then the other big technological breakthrough, two other ones that Matos mentions in the second chapter that I want to mention is, first, compact discs are out. This is the first year that they're a significant chunk of the market. It's still a very small chunk of the market, and they were twice the price of vinyl or cassette, they're $20 versus $10, and they're going to stay at that price point for the next 15 years or 20 years. But only 800 CDs are available in the US, but by the end of 1984, they are aiming to have 2000 available. And then the other big breakthrough was MIDI technology, which I remember hearing the hype about at the time, but not being a professional musician, I didn't understand. And when I would hear MIDI music, it would often be like, you know, video game music, like 8-bit or 16-bit, you know, dinky little sounds. I didn't understand, but now I understand. What it did was that the difficulty with synthesizers is making them sync and play together, play in tune and play in time with each other. And MIDI made it very easy to plug in. You know, you can plug in all your different synthesizers to your PC or your Mac and then control them all together. And so stuff that was like a massive, super expensive technological feat for Stevie Wonder and his team in the 70s when they banked multiple synthesizers together suddenly became very easy. And that's MIDI is one of the reasons you see this huge wave of British synth pop bands that were not well-financed tech geniuses along, you know, to be compared with Stevie Wonder and the team he was working with in the 70s. So, so the tech is moving along, and the formats are moving along. So we're setting the ground for what's going to be a very good year in music in 1984. You got any final thoughts on radio and Betamax and CDs? Did you have a Betamax or a VCR?
I did not, and I had a friend who worked at a TV station. They still used Beta on some filming that they did or videotaping that they did. I did finally get a VHS, and I was a late adopter. Same with CDs. What I find myself thinking about, though, is that the chapter that, you know, that we're talking about and all the technological changes, I didn't really feel them until I was in a band again at the end of the 80s, which is after this happened, when it had progressed a little more. It was 88. So I was in a band with a guy who really wanted us to go all digital. And that included programming drums, which I was not very happy about.
Yeah, that was a big and painful transition for a lot of drummers. So that's it for this chapter. I think next week we'll come back and we'll cover the second British invasion. I think that we can devote one episode to that chapter, which is Britain Rocks America Again, January 23rd, 1984. That was the cover story of Newsweek. So for Ed Legg, I'm Nate Wilcox, and we'll be back next time to continue our discussion of Michelangelo Matos' book, Can't Slow Down, How 1984 Became Pop's Blockbuster Year. Ed, thanks so much.
Rock on.
Follow the Let It Roll podcast on Twitter, at Let It Rollcast, and check out our website at letitrollpodcast.com. Thursday, we're kicking off a special 6-part miniseries about the three kings of mid-century American pop, Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, and Elvis Presley. Let It Roll is a Pantheon podcast, and you can listen to more great podcasts at www.pantheonpodcasts.com.
Hey, this is Liberty DeVito.
This is Mike Del Judas.
This is Michael Cavanaugh from Broadway's Moving Out.
This is John Jackson, director of the Billy Joel Archive.
This is Russell Javers.
This is Richie Cannata, and you're listening to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. It's awesome.
I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Fernino.
We're lifelong Billy Joel fans who launched a podcast in 2020 celebrating the music we love.
Whether you're looking for the greatest hits or the B-sides and rarities, you'll find it all here. And if you've ever wondered what happens behind the scenes of a concert or recording session, we've got you covered.
Join us as we explore albums, tours, band members, the latest news, and more. You'll also get a unique glimpse into the music industry straight from the musicians and other professionals who help make it all happen.
Tune into Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, at glasshousespod.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast, is a proud member of the Pantheon Podcasts Network.